of all the corruptions of brutish existence. But civilization is not merely a vanity. It's not a great competitive field of extravagance. Civilization is the individual gradually growing up to the point that he knows what is right and has the strength and courage and wisdom to do what is right. So education needs a thorough house cleaning. We do not need all this abstract kind of thing without some emphasis upon use. We can create artists and musicians and scholars. We can create lawyers and doctors and psychiatrists. We can produce all kinds of people. But the main thing education should give these young people as they grow up is the realization of the responsibility of right use. To have a skill and not know what to do with it, or a skill and consider that it is perfectly proper to abuse it for personal profit at the expense of others, is barbarism and, most of all, total ignorance. The individual who does not have a right motive for what he does is ignorant. We cannot say the motive does not exist, because in a strange way, the very person who is breaking the rules hopes that other people are not going to break them also at his expense. He doesn't want to be hurt, but he doesn't mind hurting someone else. So always education must be dedication. The individual must realize that knowledge is a divine bestowal. It is made possible by the faculties of the individual and by the basic structures of society. It is something that he must respect, something that he must use. It doesn't mean that he is less practical. He knows he must make a living. He knows that he must be responsible for his part of the world's burden. But he will know also that in making this adjustment, he is a servant of truth. He is working for a great cause, the gradual and inevitable unfoldment of human nature and collective humanity. Then when he gets down to the trades and business of life, he has his offices and his secretaries and his clerks. He has the factory with all his workmen and all this type of thing. And in his business relationships as management, he has a little universe of his own. For the individual who rules a business that has 15, 20, 25,000 employees, this ruler is a kind of God. He is something more than just an ordinary person, for he has the right, a physical right, to discharge or employ. He has the right to criticize or applaud. It is his responsibility to manage this particular group of people. Now he has responsibilities to these people. He has responsibilities that may interfere with profit. But if the responsibilities are ignored and profit becomes the principal aim, he with his business is going to be in the same general condition that the world is with its own unfinished business. He is going to find the temptation to exploit the privilege of leadership. He will exploit it politically, socially, scientifically, professionally. But the moment he exploits it, he breaks faith with truth. And the moment he breaks faith with truth, his own personal life begins to fall apart. And one of these days he will find that he has sacrificed too much to vanity and has not kept the faith that alone could make him a real person. So in business and all these fields of activity as we see them today, we see a crushing competitiveness. We see a world struggling for domination. We find people in all walks of life locked in conflict with each other. We find no one hardly willing to excuse any defect in others, but expecting to have all others excuse his defects. And little by little, every part of society comes to loggerheads. We have it today. We're no longer in a world in which people fought on the basis of principles. Now they fight over the same principles. We have many different sects of people who believe in brotherhood and are at war with themselves and each other. We find a tyranny of conflicting creeds. We find that religion is gradually entering into a great competitiveness in which it hopes to take over the world for its own creed and eliminate all others. This type of competitiveness is certainly not according to nature. In nature, variety adds to beauty. Here, we cannot tolerate variety if it interferes with our own conceptions. What would the valleys and the mountains be if there was only one kind of flower? What would we think of the wild creatures of life if there was only one breed? What do we think, or how could we get along with one system of thought if all else was removed? Everywhere, variety is life. The combinations of nature are all symmetrical and harmonic. The great music of the ages is infinite variety on a simple keyboard. And yet that variety gives us great joy and great pleasure. What would we feel like if somebody struck one note for hundreds of years and never changed? We would say it is impossible, incredible, unbelievable. So change and variety is life. It is a wonderful thing that we have a half a dozen major religions and maybe 100 smaller ones. As long as all of these religions keep their rules, do what they dedicate themselves to doing, and learn to be pleasant and tolerant with each other, variety is beautiful. But now we can't stand it. If we can't convert them, we're going to destroy them. And this is true all over the Near East at the present time. It is true in a large part of Asia, and it is increasingly true here in America. We cannot stand differences of opinion, although nobody knows who is right. Right hasn't any part in it. It's do you agree with me or don't you? Well, no matter how many times we try, there's always be somebody who doesn't agree with us. So it becomes an endless conflict, strikes and agitations and bombings. Cruelty, and we think we are civilized, grown-up people, and that the past was made up of barbarians. Many of these barbarians were much better people than we are, even though we do not realize it. And we can take their virtues and get over some of our own vices with benefit to all concerned. We know that in many parts of the world today, comparative religion is acceptable. But we are trying to kill it out here because of various motives. Some of these motives are very sincere, others are not. But the individual does not have to surrender to anything that is less than tolerance. And tolerance is more than just willingness to endure. Tolerance is the ability to get along with, to work along with these things in a constructive manner. So we think that the basic problem is a little bit like the famous three-headed Brahma in the great cave temple of Elephanta in the harbor of Bombay in India. Three faces of one God. In some of the early missals of the Christian church, Christ is represented with three faces. And all through theology, the three-faced being was part of the philosophy of the Knights Templars, and also seems to sneak into some of the mystical works of the 17th century. One being with three faces. In fact, this was one of the great problems of conflict in the early church, with the various conventions trying to decide how to solve the problem of one in three or three in one. This situation means actually that the divine power is three-faced. It has the three great likenesses, the three great visages. It has three eyes, the eye of the heart, the eye of the mind, and the eye in the palm of the hand, as we find in Oriental imagery. These three faces represent the three basic powers by which the universe was created. We don't know where and when it was created. And science doesn't seem to be in any danger of finding out. It has going to do all kinds of things. But when it gets through trying to find what's inside of the black hole, it will find another smaller black hole or a larger one, and so on, infinitum. that will not ever come to the end, because the surface of things is never final. That which must be found within things, the search inward towards cause, is the only thing that can possibly result in the release of the plan or purpose for existence. In any effect, however, regardless how you look at it, the problem goes on that each individual must find the way to use the three faces that he has within himself. Some say one face is to the future, one to the past, and one is now. All over the world there are trinities of one kind or another. The one, the beautiful, and the good was the great trinity of Socrates. There is always this threefoldness of things, this three levels of thinking, of feeling, of being, which must be brought into harmony. The hand must be trained to do the will of the spirit. And the will of the spirit does not mean to use it to knock down somebody. The problem of the hand is also the skills to create beauty, to make those things that are necessary to human good. The hand that holds the hammer is also the hand that holds the pen, writes the books, writes the songs, plays the instruments. All of these things are labors of the hand. And these labors must be taken hold of, they must be studied, they must be worked with, until the hand becomes an instrument of universal good. The good in each of us must express through the hand, because there are certain things that cannot be done except with the aid of the hand. It is the hand with which the good Samaritan must raise up his brother. The hand is the hand we shake hands with, even though at the time we do it, we may not know what we are doing. In the early days, handshaking was a very interesting thing, and maybe this has come down to us also, more than we realize. In the ancient days, men shook hands, and they shook hands with their right hands to prove they were not holding a weapon. In other words, the handshake was a symbol that the individual was not planning or aiming to hurt the other person. He was not going to cheat him. He was not going to stab him in the back. He was not going to hit him. He was going to prove conclusively that at that moment, amity existed between himself and the other person. Now, when we shake hands today, I wonder what it means. I wonder if we're sure that the fellow we shake hands with is not going to foreclose the mortgage the next day. It doesn't mean anything now. It is simply a gesture. But it had originally just as much a real meaning as any mudra or hand posture of religion. It was a symbol of brotherhood, of fraternity, of trust, of peace, and cooperation. And while it had those meanings, it was significant. Those meanings should come back. If they do not come back, the handshake means nothing. If it does not seal a cooperative relationship, it means nothing. The same way with all of the labors of the hands. Everything should have some use for it, some goodness in it. And the hands that are clasped in prayer are only acceptable to the Most High if those hands have worked for the good of mankind. We give our hands to God in prayer, and in so doing, rededicate them to the universal labor of human betterment. It's the same thing with our minds. We have minds, we have all kinds of thoughts. Some of them are not anything to brag about, and some are really quite noble in their way. The great sermon, the great poem, the great literary epic, the great book on philosophy or theology, all these things are products of the mind in action. The mind's purpose is to be dedicated to the advancement of the common good. The mind has to work out a whole series of decisions in itself. It must realize that it can contribute humor and happiness, that it can make life easier by properly addressing a need. We also find out that the mind is the better for the wider knowledge it possesses. But knowledge is not necessarily merely book reading. The great knowledge comes from daily living. Paracelsus said those who would read the book of nature must walk it with their feet. The kind of knowledge that we find in Bacon's essays is a knowledge that comes from a quiet contemplation of what is real and what is necessary and what is good. It is a sifting out of things that are useless. It is the ability to curb the tongue when it might otherwise say something that is unpleasant. And of course, the mind must never prevaricate. It must never lie. It must never bring false witness. It never swear to something that is not true. Nor should it try to sell inferior products by a big advertising program. All of the great industrial activities are keyed to mind, but a great many of them are a use of the mind to exploit the lives of other people. We can protect ourselves against this, and we can try in our own lives and our own ways to use the mind always for as much good as possible. That we use it to think things through, that we use it to decide how we can serve others best, that we can use it to remind us of jobs and duties, responsibilities, and most of all, that it is an alchemist by means of which all responsibilities can be transmuted into opportunities. All these things are parts of the mind's labor. It must gain all knowledge that it can and use all that it has gained for the common good of all that lives. This was another one of Bacon's thoughts. Also, we come now again back to religion. Religion, in a mysterious way, is the sum of everything. Religion to each nation, each generation, each people has been a little different. But it is always the supreme over thing. Very few have really attempted to explain it completely. We know the various forms of worship. In Peru, for example, the natives worship God by kissing the sunlight. A very abstract and unphysical approach. They didn't want to have any physical form. In the Orient, letters and sounds of an alphabet take the place of figures in the worship of deity. But what is the real answer to it all? Is this strange sense that we must have, which is the basis of an appropriate humility towards everything of life. We are in the midst of mystery. We have not solved this mystery. It is very possible that we can never solve this mystery until we become with it in an infinite future. That the only way we can ever know deity is to gradually grow up to the understanding of the infinite power at the source of life. In the meantime, religion is the great benevolent mystery. We have given it all kinds of names and thoughts. We believe that when we pray, our prayer is heard by something. We believe that in the emergency, we are strengthened by faith in God. And that faith is faith in something. Something above ourselves, something more powerful, more useful, more immediate. Most people of religious belief feel convinced that deity is approachable, that they cannot understand deity, but that deity can understand them. And in this understanding, they await the will of deity. And this will of deity is something that the world has loved from the beginning, and however it interprets or however we try to study it, there is an immense strength there, the only strength man has. How can he have strength in institutions which he will sometimes survive or which may for a short time survive him? How can he have confidence and faith and satisfaction in situations which have no value to anyone actually, including himself? How can he substitute wealth for peace of heart or peace of mind? How can adventure and change and emotional stimulation take the place of this inward appreciation of value? Every individual, therefore, has to have this inner part of himself. And this inner part is the three-faced God. For all parts of knowledge science, religion, and philosophy are attributes and aspects of one power. They are the basic breaking of one light upon a prism. They are the one power manifesting on three levels of function. There are other levels, but we do not know them. But in all things, the three move together. And the very processes of learning bring both the others into focus. There can be no philosophy without religion and science. There can be no science without religion and philosophy. And there can be no philosophy itself, or no religion, or any of these things, except in the compound of the three. They must work together. They are aspects of one thing, conditions of one quality, expressions of one life. And in this time, where we are under such burden of stress and so many problems are afflicting us, it seems very important that the individual should try to get rid of the conflicts and prejudices and conceits which he has regarded as loyalties. What is loyalty? Finally, it is loyalty to truth as we know it, or as we are capable of understanding it. Truth for man is relative. It is truth for his kind in its own time. He must try to supply that which is necessary to preserve the best in things as they are, rescue the best from things that have been, and dedicate the best to the unfinished labors of the future. All these things are part of the problem of living. We don't want to have it appear, however, that this all adds up to a pretty heavy job, that it's something that we should approach with trepidation. Actually, the doing it right procedure is 1,000 times more simple than what we are trying to do for the most part today. We are not really achieving in comparison to the energy that we are expending. It is very much like the problem of taxation. The taxes go up, but the buying power of the money goes down. And in all the money that we spend, we may still not be able to actually bring the necessities of life to the human beings on this planet. We can't do it this way. We cannot solve our problems by trying to follow political structures or any of the traditional values. The world is more inhabited now. In the time of Plato or Socrates or Pythagoras, there probably were less than 500 million people on Earth. Today we are pressing 6 billion. We have a world that is more and more indebted to a little planet. A little planet that is our hope of glory and our hope of salvation. We have done everything we could do to wreck that planet. We haven't followed the Egyptians, who refer to our planet as Mother Earth and worship it as the source of all life. We don't worship the Earth anymore. We're too sophisticated for that. We're too smart and too wise to pay homage to our own source of life. We are not worshiping the earth, but also we are therefore not careful of our use of what the earth provides. We do not recognize the harvest as a marvelous gift of nature, and we are not certain as to whether or not the farmer can continue to survive. All the things that would make things a little nicer, a little better, have in them an element of worship. There has to be something that we care for. Something that is just a little more sacred than we have considered it usually. Our petroleum is something also that we just go out and use it. We don't realize the fact that maybe someday we won't have it. And therefore, our best process would be to be wise, loving, unselfish now, and help to keep these resources as long as possible. It is astonishing, one of the great wonders of nature, that the earth is able to sustain us. That in some mysterious way, even though populations increase, they survive. And they survive because there is something more than physical structure to the earth. It is a center upon which energies from the sun and from other planets converge and keep a constant process of reformation and rehabilitation. The earth is forever producing not only the grain in the earth, but in the clouds, the water, everything, nature has given us a tremendously complicated and incredible boat on which to sail across the sea of life. It has given us something that no human being could conceivably make. And behind the little part of it that we see is an intricate machinery extending throughout the whole of space. We are part of a tremendous thing. And this tremendous thing is obviously dedicated to good. As far as we can see, it is working for us. It is doing for us everything that is necessary to keep us alive. Everything that nature does is constructive and productive until man abuses it. So we are going to have to recognize religion as a reformation that gives us the internal insight to stop abusing the natural benefits and benevolences with which we are surrounded. Everything is part of something good. A man is a kind of a wayward child. The individual is a little bit of a delinquent and a little bit of a perpetual adolescent, but he can get over both with a little effort. And now, in this time particularly, we are beginning to realize the facts of life. We are realizing the fact that each day may bring a new complication. We are realizing the fact that half the world today is locked in struggle to the death. We are in the evidence that the various policies and various patches we have put on world conditions are not right and are not holding. Therefore, we are now getting very close to the time when we have no real recourse, no escape from the terrible necessity of doing something right. We are going to be finding that unless we do it as it was intended, we will continue to have trouble. But if we do keep the rules, they will keep us. So now, in the middle of a great emergency, more and more people are beginning to think. They are beginning to dream of getting together and doing things. They are beginning to realize the concept that was set forth in Bacon's New Atlantis, which he said, which is America, and in which, according to his concept as a scientist, there would be a great world of progress, great libraries, great schools, great laboratories, observatories, a vast accumulation of truth-seeking facilities. And he says that these truth-seeking facilities, all the products of human ingenuity in this wonderful new world, will be dedicated unconditionally to the advancement and well-being of humanity. There will no longer be development for private profit, in that sense of the word. But everything that man discovers will be used to help man to grow. Now, we've made more discoveries probably in this country than all the rest of the world put together. Now comes the time to redeem these discoveries, to convert them to a great moral ethical code, to make them part of a worldwide and eternal program of fulfilling the divine purpose as it has been set in the hearts and souls of human beings. If we do this, we'll find an answer. And, of course, we will do it, because nature will keep on making us miserable until we're tired of it, until we suddenly wake up someday and say, this misery is due to me and not to the universe. I'm not the victim of a despotism somewhere out in the vicissitudes of space. I am the individual who, in the presence of right, have continued to be selfish, who have continued to think of myself only in a time when everyone must unite for the common labor of survival. Out of all conflict, then, may come an alchemical form of transmutation. The base elements of the human experience, whether it's social, political, religious, philosophical, economic, all of these base elements must be transmuted into not only pure gold, but according to the alchemists themselves, the elixir of life. Out of all these experiences must come the nutrition of enlightenment, a nutrition by which all people working together, using the resources of nature as they were intended to be used, and finding out the meaning of things, and dedicated to the right use of everything we know and possess. As this time comes, we'll find our problems fade away. And instead of being poor little outlawed creatures who have nothing to live for because we can no longer be dishonest, we will be very happy creatures, realizing that from the beginning we would have been happy if we kept the rules, and that until we keep the rules, problems will pile up. So the basic fact today is to keep the rule, to find all that we can on every branch of learning that can tell us what to do now that is permanent, what is solutional for ourselves, how to get rid of the nagging grudges and all the selfishness and bitterness and conspiracy with which we have burdened the human race. When we find the answer to that which is making us miserable, we will find that we will be happy, and that happiness is not something in which we can no longer do what we want. Happiness is now and can be in the future the magnificence of doing what we should, and by so doing, being a better world for ourselves and those who come after us. The basic problem today is to get back to the principles, to get back to the common values of life as stated in every great religion in the world and believed by practically everyone who has lived prior to this glorious era of enlightenment in which we believe in nothing. To get back the sinful beliefs of childhood, to get back to love as a solution and hate as something that died out long ago. When we get to this type of point in the condition in our own lives, we will find it's not going to be too hard to keep the world happy and to keep our planet floating quietly, gracefully, and peacefully in orbit. It is up to us to do these things. If we make mistakes, we must correct them. Nature is patient. Nature can absorb into itself all mistakes. But the problem of absorbing a major mistake is a little uncomfortable, and we should try in every way possible to avoid that. Get back to the basic, simple facts of life. And let all the involvements and all the pretty patterns rest for the moment and realize there is no answer to the problem of survival for us and growth and progress except to make the necessary changes in our own natures so that we can live together in peace, serving each other and worshiping God with a clear conscience. Well, that's it, folks.